This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Well, hello, everybody. I am Fauna Foreman. I co-direct the UCSD Center on Global Justice, and I'm delighted to welcome you to this conversation between Mary Robinson and Professor V. Ramanathan from the Scripps Institute of Oceanography. It's really very exciting to bring together two giants in the world of climate from the realms of university research and global action. And I'd like to thank them both for being here to talk about their work and the essential convergence between these realms. If we are, you know, to be successful at all moving forward. I'm going to restrain myself and forego formal introductions at this point because I know our distinguished moderator will elicit interesting information in the course of his early questions. But just to say that it's really an honor for me working in a center devoted to solving some of the world's most intransigent problems through collaborative research, to be on stage with two people who have done so much to illuminate not only the dangers of climate, and particularly the dangers of climate for the least well-off among us on the planet, but also to illuminate paths toward solutions in different sectors, university research as well as political action of varying scales. Before launching in, I just want to say that this visit by Mary Robinson to campus to speak on climate justice emerged from an initiative on this campus, which was actually articulated by our executive vice chancellor last year, an initiative devoted to collaborative energy research, which ideally would bring researchers together from across the campus, so that to deal with an amorphous and complex problem like climate, you need to bring together people who are working in the sciences, clearly, people who are working on climate and energy and so forth, but also people in medicine, people in the social sciences, to think about actually how communities, you know, receive new technology. It's not so obvious just because we come up with scientific solutions that communities who can make use of it are ready to receive it. So there are all sorts of collaborations that are necessary to tackle a problem as complex and multifaceted as climate. So, you know, there's this initiative on campus to bring people together. There's amazing research on this campus going, you know, all across the campus on these issues. And the idea of the Advanced Energy Initiative is to bring people together to learn how to collaborate. And last, I would just like to introduce our moderator for this conversation, Roger Bingham. Roger is co-founder and director of the Science Network, basically an online public square focusing on issues at the intersection of science and social policy. His interviews at the Science Network, I have to say, are truly remarkable, and I feel honored that he's here to join us in this project. Roger is a member of the Computational Neurobiology Laboratory at the Salk Institute and of the Institute for Neural Computation here at UC San Diego. He's also a member of the Board of Advisors of Scientific American Magazine, and he's received many awards for his work, including the National Magazine Award and 7 Emmy Awards. So thank you, Roger, and I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks very much, Fauna, and welcome to a conversation on climate justice. Before we start, before I even introduce people, how many of you are familiar with the concept of global warming?
Great.
Right, everybody. How many of you are persuaded by the facts that there is global warming?
Even better.
How many of you are familiar with the concept of climate justice? Lesser number. We have some work to do.
Okay, that's okay.
All right, but that's excellent. My guests, very, very briefly to do the introduction, since you've heard some of it already, Mary Robinson, first woman president of Ireland, former United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, and an organization that she founded, Realizing Rights, the Ethical Globalization Initiative. She now actually has the Mary Robinson Foundation for Climate Justice. And also joining me, as Fauna explained, is Veerabhadran Ramanathan. And he's given me permission to say Rum from now onwards, who's obviously likes alliteration because he's director of the Center for Clouds, Chemistry and Climate at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. But more importantly for this debate, he was the founder of Project Surya, which we will talk about later as a specific example of what we're talking about here today. I wonder if I could get you to set the stage, first of all, by just doing a brief overview of the whole notion of climate justice, what it is, why we should be familiar with dates like Copenhagen 2009 and whatever's going to happen in 2015, just for people who don't have a full grasp of the thing, like me.
Well, briefly, climate justice, Roger, starts with the injustice of the impacts of climate, that it's already affecting negatively smallholders, indigenous people, people living in quite poor circumstances, but in vulnerable climate countries. And it's not a thing of the future for them. It's already having a very big impact. So I didn't come to the climate issue as a scientist, and I know this is an area where there's a lot of science, a lot of expertise. That wasn't the way that I learned about it. I just listened. I was in a significant number of African countries doing work for my previous organization called Realizing Rights. We were working on issues of health, right to health, with a number of African countries and civil society. We were working on women, peace and security in a number of countries of conflict, working on corporate responsibility in African countries, working on decent work, because work is also a human right under Article 23 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And I kept hearing what I felt was a kind of negative sentence beginning with, but things are so much worse. We don't have any seasons anymore. We used to know when to sow and when to harvest. Now we have long periods of drought and then flash flooding. Or in Liberia, for example, the rainy seasons were no longer predictable. And my friend Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, the first woman elected president of an African country, would say to me, Mary, when I was growing up in Liberia, we knew to the week when the rainy seasons would come. There were two rainy seasons, and they were important for all our predictions of sowing, etc. Now we don't know when the rainy season will come or for how long. And I can't mend my roads. I can't do anything. My whole economy is affected by this. And so it went on. And I realized this was undermining important human rights to food and safe water and health and education and shelter. And I read more and more and became more and more aware. This was just a huge human rights issue. But it was a people issue. It was a justice issue. And I was reading about conflicts about science, debating the facts, as if this hadn't any impact on people. And it seemed to be about melting glaciers and even polar bears on melting icebergs. And I do like polar bears, but I was hearing a very different story over and over again and increasingly. And these were people with no plan B, no insurance, whose livelihoods were being undermined. And Constance O'Kellett, my friend from northern Uganda, said, at first we thought God was punishing us. And then we learned it was the lives of rich people. And that was, for me, you know, a moment of realizing we needed to be engaged on climate justice. And we need to figure out how to address these issues, including by access to affordable renewable energy.
Let me give you a simple definition of climate justice that anybody would look up. First thing that comes up on Wikipedia. Climate justice is generally used as a term for viewing climate change as an ethical issue, mm-hmm. and considering how its causes and effects relate to concepts of justice, particularly social justice and environmental justice. This can mean examining issues such as equality, human rights, collective rights, and historical responsibility in relation to climate change. But you're not saying, of course, that you eschew the science that goes into
not
this.
At all. No, I think climate justice has to stay true to the science, but talk about climate from a people perspective.
Right. So this is an enterprise that must bring together, then, in an interdisciplinary fashion, much like the centre that the Fana is now enthusiastically running, people from all sorts of walks of life. I mean,
it links human rights. The Human Rights Council of the United Nations is increasingly passing resolutions about the negative impacts of climate change on all of the human rights. We're seeing predictions that by 2020, which is in 37 years' time, we could have 200 million climate displaced people. Very, very significant toll of human misery to be displaced from your home, displaced from your small island, displaced from your community by the impacts of climate. And so it links human rights, development, the poorest communities and poor people, and large parts of emerging economies like China, India, Brazil, South Africa have a right to development. And they're claiming we need to be able to use fossil fuel like rich countries did. And if they do to the extent we did, we have no prospect of a safe world. But they have a right to development. So how do we square that ethically, morally, and in justice?
One last thing, and then we'll talk some specifics with Ram as well. In one of the pieces of yours that I've read, you talk about using the lens of climate justice. You talk about a compass for steering and so on. I mentioned to you when I saw you earlier today, the trouble is that a compass pretty much anywhere on the planet, unless there's something funky going on, if it says north, then it is north. The compass that is being used to drive their aspirations in different countries is not always pointing the same way. Mm. So what kind of bodies are going to be involved in producing that sort of collaborative enterprise?
Well, we actually have a framework that we should be very attentive to. And the framework is about the year 2015. Because at the end of 2015, governments of the world have committed to have a new climate agreement. They've done that at the conference in Durban, South Africa, and they repeated it at Doha last December. They're not working hard enough at it, and they're not addressing issues of equity as much as they should be, but the commitment is there. And we have another big commitment, which is to complete as well as we can, especially for more fragile countries, the Millennium Development Goals that are to be reviewed at the end of 2015 and will be replaced, it seems, by sustainable development goals that all countries, the United States, European countries, Korea, Japan, as well as poor developing countries, will have. Sustainable development goals. We don't know what the sustainable development goals are going to be unless we define sustainability by having a climate agreement that says this is how we stay below 2 degrees Celsius. This is the commitment governments have to enter into. We're not there. But certainly for young people in the audience, I would say get very engaged in this. It's about your future. I would say get very angry about the lack of progress. Get active and campaign about this because it's extremely important.
All right, let's get a specific case. So Ram, if you could explain a little bit about Project Surya. I suppose on the site, your website, which I encourage people to go and look at, it says that it aims to mitigate the regional impacts of global warming by immediately and demonstrably reducing atmospheric concentrations of black carbon, methane, and ozone. So what we're talking about here is cooking stoves, isn't it? And how to...
Yes, yeah. Thanks, Roger. First, I'm really honored to share the stage with the pioneer of climate justice. I want to just address a couple of points which came up with Mrs. Robinson and then go to the issue. The climate justice issue is multidimensional. If you look at the global issues, the global warming now we experience is not from the emissions we put yesterday. It's a cumulative emissions over the last 100 years, particularly carbon dioxide. And the second piece of information I want to give you, we have already dumped enough gases on the planet, about a trillion tons, to warm the planet by more than 2 degrees already, 2.5. Then you ask, who's responsible for this? Since it's cumulative emissions, it's the emissions, about 70% of it is from the developed nations. So that's one of the main crux of the issue. Our worry about in India and China are real, but what they put over the next 30, 40 years, not last year. So keep that in mind. That's the dimension of the justice argument, at least politically happening, but I have participated. The second is, this is something Mrs. Robinson has talked eloquently, if you go to her website, there are 3 billion who have no access to fossil fuels. 3 billion, mind you. So we are left behind about 40% of the planet with nothing to access as energy. We all know, as Ms. Robinson already emphasized, they're the ones who are most vulnerable to climate change. So keep that too in mind. So now I'll go to the Project Surya issue. It turns out, if you ask, as my distinguished colleague David Victor wrote this beautiful book, that he's from this campus, sorry for bragging about my colleagues, on gridlock. So we are basically gridlocked. The CO2 is a 38 billion ton gorilla each year, and it's growing. And we're not being able to do anything. So it has given a sense of gloom and doom that there's nothing we can do because it's related to energy. It turns out 40% of the global warming is from pollutants other than carbon dioxide. And these are methane, fluorocarbons used as refrigerants, soot, which I'm going to talk about, and ozone, which is a smog. The beauty of them is that they are short-lived. If we collectively get rid of black carbon, soot, today, they're gone a few weeks from now. And in fact, California, we just released this report, cut down its soot emissions by 50% just in the last 15 years by putting filters. And they offset their global warming by almost about a third of what they need to do. So UCSD, this campus, played a dominant role in bringing up the short-lived climate pollutants. And Mrs. Clinton, you know, declared this program Climate and Clean Air Coalition. And we were recognized officially that this was February. Now 25 nations have joined. I'm happy to say her husband listens to her. And today, in a dinner in India 6 hours ago, in the dinner, guests, surprised, all of them were talking about black carbon and HFCs. So there is a hope. It turns out, and the other thing, Ms. Robinson, is that these 4 pollutants, we have technologies. We don't need to invent anything. And we can offset 50% of the warming over the next 30 years and thus let the CO2 start. We have to start CO2. So one of the major, I focus on black carbon or soot. It's the same stuff which comes out of diesel. It's the same stuff which comes out of fire when you burn firewood. So this 3 billion burned firewood and cow dung. And this black carbon is about 2/3 of the air pollution over South Asia. So overnight, we know how to cook without producing smoke. So we started this project Surya to demonstrate that it's done. It's possible. It will cut down the global warming. It will cut down all the health effects and at the same time improve the lives of women. Okay? And if I can I show the video now? Just it will take about a minute and a half.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar, Allah.
It's 2 in the morning and Shabnam's kitchen is already buzzing.
Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah.
It's Ramadan, the holy month of fasting for Muslims. The meal has to be eaten before the break of dawn. At this unusual hour, Shabnam has a few unlikely visitors. A group of researchers have to conduct an experiment in her kitchen. This effort, they hope, will make life a little better for rural women like Shabnam.
So let me just take about a minute to summarize this and then we go on. We have tested improved stoves, still uses firewood because that's free fuel for them. And we showed it cut down fuel consumption by 50%. And it cut down the smoke by 80%. And why that's a big deal is that the women, each year, they have to bring up 1.5 tons of firewood. And there's no help from any of the men or the boys. I spent 8 weeks in villages in India, and I know from firsthand, it's collected by women and girls. And roughly, they have to bring about 20 pounds each day. And because of the long wet season, 4 months, you can't use firewood, so they have to collect about 0.5 ton in the next 2 months. So cutting that factor of two, it's a big issue, and they all appreciate it. I have not found evidence for the statement cultural preferences, they don't want to use their stoves. And the second is about 3.5 million die every year, inhalation of the smoke. This is the recent WHO, mainly amongst women and children. So the issue, the sustainability we are facing, our stoves are way too expensive. It's about 1.5 months of their pay scale. So now we are on this scaling up issue. We are now connecting them directly with voluntary carbon markets using cell phones. And that's why I spent this last 8 weeks. I'm pleased to say we have now opened up about 50 so-called energy entrepreneurs to sell these stoves, maintain them. They are made locally. And we have connected them with the rural bank and University of California, to its credit, has opened a climate mitigation fund so people can donate and it goes directly to pay the carbon credits. So and the one distinction of what we are trying to do is each woman, a cell phone would document if she's using our stove. The data will come here and she will get credited every month. So, and the last thing I want to say is that this campus, as Fauna mentioned, about 6 or 7 departments have gotten together and to work together. This is including political science, anthropology, Scripps, chemistry, business school, and the Relations of Pacific Studies School. We are collecting together to see what can we do to go across our disciplines and get some relief from climate change over the next 3-4 decades.
Let me ask you both, since you've just been there and on the ground, it's wonderful to come up with theoretical ideas, but then to be pragmatic about it and get them put into operation by the people on the ground. How difficult is that? I mean, do you get any resistance in terms of, we've been doing this for thousands of years, go away? And
before I answer that, let me give you my bias. I am a hopeless optimist, so you're never going to get me from problems. But what I found, and that's why I had videos of women, because of the influence of TV, they now know life doesn't have to be like this. So they are so, at least the ones we have seen, we have now distributed 2,000 stoves already. We have found no resistance to usage of them. The main problem, Roger, is that the technology is not, they are not user-friendly yet. They are gimmicky stoves developed in pristine labs here with very little understanding of what the woman needs. And that's why I showed that video. See that the traditional mud stove not only provides heat, it provides light. There's no electricity. So with our energy efficient stove, we've cut off their lighting. So those are some of the technical reasons, but they are all solvable problems. But the women now, they say they are ashamed to collect firewood on their head every day. They are ashamed of how dark their kitchen is, and they've used a stove and found. So I think they're ready. The problem is finance. They don't have the money to buy. Our stoves cost $70. That's about 6 weeks of their paycheck. But this sort of flies in the face of what some of the social scientists from MIT have said, that it's a cultural preference. We have not seen that, at least in the villages I worked.
Well, I've also run forums at the Women's Global Forum in Deauville and so on, and the women's issues are always coming up. I note that one of the Millennial Development Goals was to promote gender equality and empower women. How much of this, you were talking about the burden that falls on the women in India. How does that translate globally? You've gone all over the place looking at these things.
Well, it's obviously essential. I'm very supportive of Project Surya and other similar projects. We need a lot of different examples. I was in Malawi in January, and I went out with President Joyce Banda, the second woman president of an African country, where cook stoves were being distributed with support from donors, but they were made locally, made of ceramic, kind of, you know, local, I don't know, pottery. And not only that, but there was a project of using the heat from the cook stove to charge mobile phones, which is also very important and very valuable. Tomorrow, I understand, you're going to have a day of energy and climate justice. And I think this is something you should really look at and think about. Think about the numbers that Ram, if I may, has talked
Please.
About. These are very big numbers. The number I'm used to talking about is 2.6 billion who still cook on open fires with coal, with firewood, with animal dung, and who need these cook stoves. And I serve on the Leadership Council of the Clean Cook Stoves Alliance that the UN Foundation, Hillary Clinton, and others have been supporting. And there is a big, ambitious project to have 100 million households have clean cook stoves by 2020. That sounds terrific, and it is very big in comparison to now. But 100 million out of 2.6 billion? It's not really so many. So one of the things that my foundation has been doing is bringing together those who provide the cook stoves and the light in the home, the energy gadgets, with those who work in large social protection systems in poor countries. Because most poor countries know who their poor are. They actually are gathered together, but they don't provide access to energy. They may provide a goat or chickens or a cash voucher. And even if they provide a cash voucher, very poor people will not spend it on energy. They have far too many priorities. Medicine for a dying child, school fees, food, water. They don't spend it on energy. So what we need to do is think of ways to scale up that access to energy. And then it has the benefit of actually being a mitigating element. It seems interesting that the very poorest will be mitigating when those with the real responsibility, the historic responsibility and the current responsibility, and China and India now have a lot of current responsibility. China's the biggest emitter and has to take its responsibility. If we talk about historic responsibility, in 30 years' time, China will be the biggest historic emitter of all time. So we can't just have a political standoff about this. We've got to get real. And we've got to get a climate agreement that's fair and equitable by the end of 2015.
If I may add to that...
It's a conversation.
That's exactly the issue. I see this. I already declared I'm a hopeless optimist. I see this 3 billion with no access to fossil fuel. We can steer them away from the fossil fuel ladder into renewables. And I found, as you know, most of the 3 billion live in tropical region. There is abundant sunlight. Solar really works. I have seen it. Home lighting, you can make it for $20-$25. So I see our engineering department, and this is one of the issues. If we can figure out how to make tapping the sun a cheaper business, there is no question it will be adopted.
I like your eternal optimism. I spent a lot of time with Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and he doesn't describe himself as an optimist. He describes himself as a prisoner of hope.
In practical terms, what are the stages that have to go? How do you connect a grassroots movement to the people who actually sign bills and enact laws?
Well, in practical terms, we need a movement about climate justice. And that's what my small foundation and the World Resources Institute in Washington, D.C. feel very strongly about from two completely different perspectives. Because WRI is evidence-based, scientific, cares about natural resources and physical resources, produces evidence-based reports. And they have concluded, sadly, that we will not win this on science or facts, because those facts are disputed by bad money, by a huge amount of money from the fossil fuel lobbies. The amount of money is astounding. It's very corrupt. And again, I hope young people will track this. And I'm very glad that in a lot of universities, and I hope it's happening here in the University of California, San Diego, that students are saying disinvest from fossil fuel companies, because that's what needs to happen, that disinvestment process. But meanwhile, those fossil fuel companies, not perhaps all of them, but it is a real factor, are like the tobacco companies of old. It's very like that now. It's corruption to pretend that it's not causing harm. And it's causing immense harm and continuing to. So we need a movement to address the issues of equity, and not just equity and mitigation, which we've been talking about, that those historically responsible and now the big emitters have to take their due responsibility and cut their emissions and move more rapidly to low carbon and have a good future with low carbon development. But also we need equity in adaptation. What I've been very conscious of is the undermining of the human rights of women and men and children in poor countries through the impact of the weather shocks that are caused by what we've been responsible for. And equity in transfer of technologies, the work you're doing with Project Surya and other projects, we need to accelerate that dramatically. We need to really address how we use the fact that luckily solar energy is more available in the poorest parts of the world, but they're not accessing it because they don't have the technology. And also equity in climate financing. And all of this towards the end of 2015, because we're running out of time. And we have a very real prospect of a world that will be catastrophic. I mean, the World Bank has produced this report recently, Turn Down the Heat, about a 4 degrees world.
But the irony surely is, let me just press you on this, the irony surely is that although you base your movement on evidence-based perspectives, the people you're painting as the villains are using precisely the same evidence to say that you're wrong, aren't they?
The problem with science, and I'm not a scientist, so let others correct me, including on this panel, the problem with good science is it deals with probabilities, not absolute 100% certainties, especially in the climate area. And therefore, if you want to mess it up and disguise what's really happening, you can buy bad science. You can even buy bad scientists who think that they have a point, and there are a lot of them. Maybe they're too comfortable because the money is there. But it is really shocking. And it happened with the tobacco industry. I mean, that's, to me, the nearest thing to where we are now with fossil fuel. It's the money that tobacco companies used for a long time to pretend that tobacco didn't harm us. But tobacco harmed individuals and they died. The fossil fuel industry is harming the planet, and we might all, and you know, I do talk about this in very personal terms, and I'll do it here. I have 4 grandchildren. I'm a real Irish grandmother. Those grandchildren are 9 and 8 in Ireland, in Dublin, a boy and girl, and 5 and 4 in Barcelona, a boy and girl. They will be in their 40s in 2050. They will share their planet with 9 billion others under current estimates that everybody accepts. And I care about that world and all of those 9 billion. And I worry greatly about what they will say about us. because I hear the echoes back of what they will say. And the echoes back are not comforting. What they are saying is, how could they have been so stupid, so selfish, so uncaring about our problems? They had a chance to address these issues, and they didn't take it. That's what I'm hearing. That's what I wake up early in the morning, and it gets me very concerned about and passionate about climate justice, because we are running out of time, and politicians are not stepping up to the plate. We are not seeing the urgency. But in 37 years' time, in 2050, the impacts of this will be felt by my grandchildren, by the children of many of you here, and grandchildren, and their grandchildren. And they will know that it happened on our watch, and we did not do what we should do. That's what I care about a great deal.
On the issue of uncertainty, what puzzles me is that why we have failed is that uncertainty cuts both ways.
Yeah.
It is true, when I said 2.5 degree warming we have committed, it could be off by a factor of 2 either way. It could be smaller, but it could be larger. Why are we not able to persuade? We hope for the best, but plan for the
worst. Yeah. You would think particularly those who call themselves conservatives and Republicans would actually be wary about the worst and plan for that.
Well, we're not very good. There's a man called George Ainslie who's written books on this, but we're not very good at doing what he calls hyperbolic discounting. In other words, looking at the benefits of distant things. On the science,
I don't think 37 years hence is distant. To me, it's very near.
Yeah. I appreciate what you were saying there, Ram. So the you probably all remember that the original hockey stick curve that Michael Mann brought out in 1999. Only recently in science, there was Sean Marcotte had a paper which took the hockey stick back from a few hundred years ago to 2,000 years ago. And it was a much bigger hockey stick. The science is built. What's your take on this? I mean, you actually work at Scripps as well.
On that hockey stick issue, I think the scientists erred on the side of pinning too much on this hockey stick. The problem you have to understand is that if you go back 100 years, your record is not that good. There are just few stations here and there, particularly the tree rings. So that how you add up all that and get a global number is surrounded in a lot of uncertainty. But I think now that all the dust has settled and people have gone back, it is clear what we are seeing in the last 30 years is truly much warmer than anything we have seen. But there was this warm period. But the record there, we are talking about relying on 25, 30 stations as opposed to hundreds of thousands of stations now. So it was an unnecessary, unwarranted controversy.
Well, last thing on science, let me ask you something about Surya, and this is for both of you. When he came into office first term around, President Obama said his administration would restore science to its rightful place. Didn't give any coordinates. So, but what do you think is the rightful place of science?
Oh, I think that's sort of a difficult question for me. I've not thought about what the rightful place for science is. Certainly, now scientists can talk about global warming, and we could not even say that before. We had to call it climate variability. And so we are past all that stage, but somehow I'm still disappointed. In the US and elsewhere, at least the climate change science is not having the impact it should be having. Meaning scientists have clearly come and said what Ms. Robinson said. If you do business as usual, we are going to see 4 degree warming by 2100, 2 degree warming by 2050, which is just around the corner. And the whole world has recognized passing the 2 degree is an unknown threshold. But we have done nothing as a society. So to me, somewhere there is still not trust in what the scientists are saying.
Well, I'm very much guided by the head of our research and development, who's an environmental scientist, who absolutely emphasizes that we must talk about climate justice while being true to the science and listening. But science will not get us there. This has to be a human story.
Yeah.
We are all in a very unique time in human history. And I again emphasize 2015, the end of 2015, is a very key time that we must work towards, because we have a potential to be a game changer by the end of 2015 with a new climate agreement and the sustainable development goals that there's a working group working on in the United Nations. But we need a lot of political pressure for that. And it's not talked about enough. We're not aware of it. And this won't happen unless it becomes something that we really care about. So there is a rightful place for science in this. We have to be guided by it. But we have to realize that this is very much a human story and a justice story. People in this country and in other countries do care about what happens to very poor people in different parts of the world. But they're not aware. You don't read about this in the media, that there's a huge undermining of livelihoods. And the reality is, it's predicted by 2050, which is 37 years away, we may have 200 million climate refugees, people who've had to leave Bangladesh. 20 million may have to leave the Bay of Bengal. Small island states. I have a friend, Ursula Rukova, who's moving 1,500 people at the moment from a small cataract island to Papua New Guinea, to Bougainville. And she talks about negotiating, first of all, relationships. People are moving to a new place. And then land, to buy land. And there is land there, but they have to buy it. And then she says, with incredible sadness, but there is nothing I can do about the fact that we have to leave the land of the bones of our ancestors. And when she says that, I feel little hairs on the back of my neck, because that, for Indigenous peoples, is a spiritual break. And there will be a lot of that. A lot of people who will have to leave the land of the bones of their ancestors. Why are we not talking about this? Why is it not far more on the front burner for so many people? This is the biggest issue. It's the biggest human rights issue I know, which is why I established this foundation on climate justice.
Would it help if there were more very clear examples like Project Syria?
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Yeah, what I like about Project Syria and other similar projects is we need solutions. We need hope.
Right.
It's not a doom and gloom. There's a lot we can do, and there's a lot that young people can do, and there's a lot that can be talked about in your seminar tomorrow, your conference on energy and climate justice, about how we bring home that we're all in this together. It's as if, we're all in the world Titanic, and we're heading for the 4-degree world iceberg. And unfortunately, we're accelerating towards it. And if we hit even well above 2 degrees, which we look as if we will now, it will be a pretty catastrophic world. And it will be catastrophic for everyone. It's not that it's going to be just for people we are so far away that we can't even think about them. And I think we need to get that across. And that needs to be. And I do very much urge that President Obama, who I think knows this, be encouraged by the people of America to actually give leadership on climate, because the United States needs to be a leader on climate. And your new Secretary of State, John Kerry, knows the issues, and he needs to be a leader on climate. And he needs pushing by people who will hold him in the difficult circumstances, which I sort of understand, of politics in this country. It's still necessary that the United States gives leadership.
Right, but to take a very specific example, let me be devil's advocate and ask what may be a rather stupid question, but why doesn't the Indian government, coupled with all the new Indian billionaires I now see in the last issue of Forbes magazine, just go and do it? What will you have to do to get them to do it?
Do mitigation of climate change?
To develop Project Surya to a state that it becomes an exemplar that Mary can then take around the globe and say, well, look, they're doing it. Duh.
I look for an answer to that. That's in the last 8 weeks. And I think, and I met with a lot of, political scientists. stand and as in terms of mitigation of climate change is that exactly what Mr. Robinson said, that leadership has to come from the West. We'll follow. Let's do it together. But you take the leadership first. And the second, they see issues like the soot and black carbon. They are worried it's going to distract attention away from CO2 and point the finger at developing nations. So there are multiples of issues. But I think on the cook stoves, it sort of goes beyond all these issues. It's really a human rights issue. It's a development issue. It's protecting their own people. I think they India has a national cook stove problem. But I think they don't know how to solve it. So that is, to me, the beauty of the short-lived climate pollutants. It doesn't need 160 nations to sign on a piece of paper. The actions can come from ground, bottom up. And of course, we need some recognition from the top. And I again want to point out, like Surya, there are many projects from the ground working on this. And once we can show success and how to scale it up, see, we are planning to show this carbon credit thing will work for about 50,000 homes. To me, that then, I'm hoping that we'll show a black carbon hole, a pollution hole, and that I'm hoping would convince the government. So, and of course, they are battling with so many development issues, industrialization, this and that. So bottom line is, as a scientist, I don't know the answer to your question. If I were Prime Minister of India, that would be the top on my agenda. 600 to 700 million people we have left behind, whereas the other 300 million are enjoying all the comforts of modern life. It is a climate justice, it's a justice question.
Right, but justice, I mean, we're talking about morality here, we're talking about ethics, where one could invoke philosophers like John Rawls, Amartya Sen, go back to Adam Smith. But that doesn't do it. I mean, that just gets people engaged at a dinner table. So what, give us our marching orders.
Well, there are people that think that it's impossible to get any movement out of the process that is dealing with climate, the UNFCCC process, the Climate Convention, COPs, from Copenhagen to Mexico to South Africa to more recently in Doha. For what it's worth, it's a bit like a cook stove story, the Surya project. My foundation helped to form a troika of women leaders on climate change because there's such a gender dimension. When you're undermining poverty and making it harder to get food, harder to get water, it's women who have to pick up the burden of that. So we brought together a group, it's now over 60, mainly ministers of environment and energy. Michelle Bachelet, head of UN Women, is a member, and Helen Clark, head of UNDP. And we have about six men. We kind of keep men in their place, but we don't exclude them, you know. And the commitment of the Troika Plus of women leaders was to listen to those who are aware of the problem in their reality, those who are coping with the climate shocks, with no insurance, no plan B. It's destroying their livelihoods, it's making life very difficult, it's destroying the local school, and so on. And to try to make that real commitment. And at Durban in 2011, we showed that the climate world is a very male-dominated world because it is scientists, environmentalists, energy specialists. There are now women ministers, but they're in a minority. And the delegates, they're in a minority. So we said we need to change the gender balance and have a gender balance in all the bodies of the UNFCCC and the delegations. And we showed the 10-year-old decision that wasn't working to try and achieve that. And we drafted during 2012, with the help of these women leaders, a stronger draft Finland put it through the 27 EU countries, and they accepted that they would table it. We had a procedural problem, which I won't go into. But actually, in Doha, we had a negotiation for many hours, and a strong gender balance is now incorporated by decision in Doha. It's called the Doha miracle into the system. And all delegations will now have to have gender balance. It won't happen overnight, I think, but they will have to commit to it. And in the body. Now, what that brings home to me is it is possible to bring about change. It needs a lot of political energy and focus. And what we want to see in this climate justice dialogue is that every sector of the world, young people, women, the business community, the evangelical community, all say we actually have an urgent job to do together. And we have to persuade the negotiators to get real about this and stop playing off historic responsibility and China not taking its full responsibility and India not taking its full responsibility and the United States not wanting to be part of a climate agreement anyway, although they've signed up to the fact that we need a climate agreement by 2015, and everybody to get real. This is too urgent. It's too important. And we have to make it a people movement over the next couple of years, and time is very short.
All right, well, last question then for both of you. What are you optimistic about?
Oh, I'm absolutely certain we're going to solve this problem. And we need to solve it from two ends. The CO2 issue, I leave it to world leaders. The other short-lived climate, 40% of the problem, which will sort of push this 2 degree another 20, 30 years down the road, that can come from bottom up. And already, like I said, 25 nations have joined this climate and clean air coalition. So I think the good news here is it's still not too late. That's where I would like to end what I want to say. It's not too late at all.
Well, I'm a prisoner of hope, like Archbishop Tutu, and I believe that young people get this. I'm very encouraged here in San Diego as elsewhere. It's probably because it is the future of young people. They do understand that we're running out of time and that it's actually very, very important to their lifespan and their children. And therefore, I'm hoping that young people will get much more active about this. And get involved in active issues like saying we should not be investing in fossil fuel. Our universities should be giving leadership on this, and it's happening in this country. And there are a lot of good projects about it, and there are NGOs who are getting more and more active. And so it's easy for young people now to be part of what I hope will be a kind of movement on climate justice, because that is the hope for the future and the necessity, because we are, after all, rational human beings. And let's hope we can be intelligent enough to have our grandchildren be proud of us. I want my grandchildren in their 40s to be proud of what we did in the next few years. That's what I really want.
Thank you very much. A continuing conversation. Ram Ramanathan, thank you very much. Mary Robinson, thank you very much indeed.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.